precise timeline of the contract awards and the distinctions among the Defense Department's political leadership, the Air Force purchasers, and the lawmakers on the Hill who controlled the purse strings. The fact that this political battle spilled over into federal court shows how tangled the web of influence surrounding the U.S. rocket monopoly had become. Judge Braden declined ULA's request to dismiss the case, tartly noting that the court does not request or need the views of ULA, which has no basis to challenge SpaceX's standing in this case. Instead, she ordered the Air Force to disclose the details of ULA's contract to SpaceX's attorneys and ordered them to prepare a settlement proposal for mediation. The eventual mediator would be former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft. The government and United Launch Alliance tried to argue that the contract issued by the Air Force did not violate the directive issued by Kendall in 2012 to buy more launches through open competition, and that SpaceX had missed its chance to protest. SpaceX said the opposite. Lawyers dug through complex contracts and cost estimates throughout the fall. This was vital because it prevented the Air Force from hiding behind the excuse that SpaceX would not be able to meet its mission requirements. While the company was not yet prepared to fly the largest spy satellites, many of its smaller missions, particularly the newest generation of GPS satellites, were well within the company's bailiwick. The writing was clearly on the wall for ULA to see. In Congress, Senator McCain was working to pass a law banning the import of Russian rocket engines. George Sowers, who had been the primary designer of the Atlas V and warned his managers about SpaceX early on, was assigned to lead a team that would develop a plan to compete with SpaceX. "That's a big deal," Sowers told me later. "Imagine setting up a company to be a government-regulated monopoly, subsisting mostly on federal acquisition regulation contracts, and transform it to be commercially relevant." The transformation did not come quickly enough for ULA's parent companies. In August 2014, GAS, then 58, announced his retirement from the launch monopolist, in view of the challenging industry landscape. An executive from Lockheed Martin's ballistic missile business, Tory Bruno, was brought in as CEO with a mandate to make ULA competitive. In the next year, Bruno would lay off a dozen executives and begin preparations for a broader transformation that would mean reducing the entire workforce by 30% in the years ahead. But change had to be more than just cutting the fat. ULA would have to come up with a whole new vehicle to replace its new expensive rockets if it wanted to begin competing with SpaceX. The company called its new rocket design Vulcan, still unable to escape the tug of Greek mythology. It would upgrade in steps, beginning with a powerful new booster stage that would, in effect, be able to replace both Atlas and Delta boosters in flying ULA's Centaur second-stage vehicle. Then the company would replace the Centaur with something called the Advanced Cryogenic Evolved Stage, or ACES, with even more power to shoot large satellites directly into ultra-high orbits. This was all fine and good, but the biggest problem would be coming up with a whole new engine and fast, since importing the RD-180 just wasn't politically tenable. With its monopoly in danger, ULA was already looking at serious cost-cutting. Finding $1 billion or so to invest in a powerful orbital rocket engine would mean cutting back on the steady flow of cash heading to its parent companies, and having to do so in a joint venture that already boasted a complicated cost-sharing agreement. Public markets were likely to look askance at putting up the funds to help a stumbling legacy company compete with new entrants unburdened by historical costs. Yet amazingly, there was someone out there who had the money to pour into such a venture, someone who was already competing with SpaceX. His name was Jeff Bezos. Blue Origin had an existing relationship with ULA. When Bezos's company was dabbling in NASA's Commercial Crew partnership, it intended to use the Atlas V to carry its capsule into space. One of Blue's business development executives was Brett Alexander, who had worked at NASA on the space taxi program and had consulted with Sowers at ULA. He stayed in touch with his old employer, giving him hints about the super-secret engine development work going on at Bezos's closely guarded space firm. When ULA began looking for a new engine, Blue pitched it some promising ideas, and just as important, adapted its plans to ULA's preferences for Vulcan, increasing the thrust by 25% for the larger vehicle. The engineering appeared to make sense, but as with NASA, the promise of self-financing sealed the deal. The business deal they were willing to offer us was a business deal you only dream about, Sowers told me. You have a supplier to take all of the development risk on themselves and most of the cost. Other companies were considered for the job, and Aerojet Rocketdyne was brought on as a competitor, thanks in part to the longtime contractor's backing in Congress. But it was clear that Blue Origin held the pole position, a fact made clearer after remarks by ULA's Vice President of Engineering, Brett Tobey, to a classroom full of students, were leaked online. Tobey was a victim of his own generosity. In March 2016, he candidly shared with students at the University of Colorado the reality of the aerospace business, right down to the importance of political connections. McCain basically doesn't like us, he said on the recording. He's like this with Elon Musk, and so Elon Musk said, why don't you guys go after ULA and see if you can get that engine to be outlawed? On the other hand, Tobey noted that, we have this friend. I told you about that big factory down in Alabama, Decatur. This is Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama. But from a business standpoint, his most telling remarks concerned the engine competition between Blue and Aerojet. We're sitting here as a groom with two possible brides, Tobey said. We've got Blue Origin over here, the super rich girl. Then we've got this poor girl over here in Aerojet Rocketdyne. The chances of Aerojet Rocketdyne coming in and beating the billionaire is pretty low. We're putting a whole lot more energy into BE4 Blue Origin. Tobey would resign after his views were published by the media, but the reality he described was one lamented by those companies without a wealthy patron like Musk or Bezos. You have these well-capitalized businesses with very, very long-term plans without any near-term or medium-term expectation of return on investment, James Mazur, the SpaceX president who later ran Aerojet, told me. That has really upset the traditional business model. The new partnership between the country's biggest aerospace contractors and Bezos' private R&D shop signaled the pressure SpaceX was putting on the traditional rocket launch business. There is no way that ULA would have considered buying engines from Blue Origin except for the pressure that SpaceX put on them, Mueller, SpaceX's engine guru, said later in leaked remarks of his own. The deal was something of a masterstroke for ULA. The threatened incumbents had found an ally in exactly the kind of disruptive company eating away at their bottom line. SpaceX had denied Blue Origin a launch pad in 2013. Now Blue was stepping in to bolster SpaceX's most powerful rival just when Musk's company had the government contractor on the ropes. If battle lines hadn't been drawn before, they were now. To be sure, the intervention couldn't come quick enough to prevent Musk from wedging his company into the competition for government launches. ULA made one last legal gambit in early 2015, arguing that a recently passed funding bill, which technically banned the use of Russian rocket engines while making an exemption for ULA's contracts, had ratified the block buy. Judge Braden once again slapped down this argument, saying that SpaceX still had a case and that she was prepared to rule on it if mediation failed to result in a settlement. In the end, a sealed settlement was indeed agreed to by SpaceX and the U.S. Air Force. Despite the legal wrangling, the settlement did not kill ULA's block buy. Defense officials ultimately would not risk the supply chain for the heavy rockets that only ULA could provide. For this reason, the deal could be seen as a defeat for SpaceX. At the same time, the publicity of the suit and the scrutiny of the deal made clear that this paradigm would not continue, and for that reason, SpaceX claimed at least a moral victory. And perhaps more. The block buy's estimated cost fell to $11 billion, as officials shifted more optional launches into competitive bidding ahead of schedule. SpaceX was offered a path to certification ahead of schedule, and later in 2015, the company would win the right to launch a GPS satellite for the Air Force, its first successful bid on a national security contract. This would mark the end of ULA's monopoly on American national security launches, a major moment for SpaceX, which had been derided by the incumbent virtually since its founding. Musk's company was now flying satellites for all comers and pushing toward human spaceflight through NASA's Commercial Crew Program, though budget cuts had pushed back the first planned flight another year. Yet, this was hardly enough for Musk, or for the team at SpaceX. If all we do is be yet another satellite launcher, or only as good as the Soyuz in cost per person to orbit, that would be okay, but really not a success in my book, Musk had said in 2007. By 2015, his company was on its way to matching the full spectrum of what rocket engineers had accomplished before. To truly change the game, to make Martian colonization practical, SpaceX would have to do something no one had ever done before. It would have to make its rockets reusable, to drive the cost down not through mere efficiency, but by way of a total paradigm shift. This vital fact was clear to Musk and his team, but it was also clear to Bezos and his team. Which is why, the same year Musk sued the Air Force, he also took Bezos' company to court. Why? Blue Origin had patented his idea to land rockets on boats. Chapter 13. Reduce, reuse, recycle. It would be a mistake to consider that reuse is the alpha and omega of breaking innovation in the field of launchers. Stefan Israel, CEO of Arianespace. Since the very beginning of SpaceX, the company has dedicated itself to a fairly obvious intuition. What if we don't throw away the rocket when we're done using it? Nearly every rocket ever made has been designed to be thrown away. The Space Shuttle Orbiter was unique as a reusable space vehicle, but it relied on jettisoning its solid fuel rocket booster and an enormous fuel tank mid-flight. The boosters were recovered from the ocean, refurbished, and reused. Satellite launching rockets were thrown away entirely. The reasoning for this reliance on expendability was simple. There's already a tiny margin of error involved in reaching orbit. Remember, most space vehicles are 85% propellant by mass. Adding the gear to make a rocket reusable increases mass and further reduces that margin. And bringing that rocket back down to Earth in one piece involves exposing it to the harsh conditions of re-entry, which could harm it enough to make reusability pointless. Rocket builders also didn't think it was worth investing that money in solving these problems, because there just weren't enough launches happening to justify the expense. It was cheaper to make throwaway rockets than to invest in reusable rockets. Unless, that is, you thought you would be able to fly them a lot more often than before, In 2015, George Sowers, then the Vice President of Human Launch Services at United Launch Alliance, was intrigued by SpaceX's ideas and attempted to figure out if they were onto something. He came away unconvinced. Can you actually bring it back and refurbish it for lower cost than to build a new one? Sowers asked me rhetorically. I've done a lot of analysis. I've convinced myself that, at least with today's technology, the answer is no. Executives at other big rocket makers echoed that view. Musk and his team disagreed from the get-go. If he was going to spend so much of his own money, particularly on the expensive engines, he wasn't about to throw them away. More important, reusability was the only way to lower the cost of launch dramatically enough to match his ambitions. Musk had a simple analogy. The cost of building his rockets was comparable to that of a 737 airliner, but because they were thrown away after a single use, their cost per flight was wildly higher. While the cost of building the rocket was around $54 million, the propellant used in each Falcon 9 flight cost only about $200,000. If the company could reuse even just the first stage, it estimated that it could cut the price by about a third. SpaceX's expendable rocket was already dramatically cheaper than those of its competitors. But effective reusability would essentially end the competition entirely. For the Falcon 1, SpaceX engineers originally expected that the first stage would be able to return to Earth via a parachute, where it would then be fished from the sea. The challenges of testing that rocket and its eventual cancellation meant that this plan never came to fruition. As the Falcon 9 was developed, it became clear that parachutes would be insufficient for returning the 20-ton first stage back to Earth. Return from space brings us back once again to the physics of getting there. Remember, your vehicle's velocity must exceed 17,500 miles per hour to stay in orbit. To return to Earth, you have no choice but to plunge back into the atmosphere at extremely high speed. As you do, the vehicle smacks into the air in front of you, cramming the gas tightly together and making it enormously hot. While it's comparatively easy to make metal structures that can withstand the physical force of reentry, dealing with the high temperatures is a more difficult engineering challenge. Space vehicles have typically relied on special shapes to move that heat away from vital areas, and special materials are used that can absorb this energy. The Apollo and the Soyuz space capsules let their blunt bellies take the heat of reentry before deploying parachutes. The much larger reusable space shuttle counted on its heat shielding to absorb the force, then used its glider body to slow down in a series of wide turns before landing on the runway. Yet it, too, was a cautionary tale, not just because the Columbia disaster revealed how vulnerable the shielding could be, but because the expense of refurbishing it turned out to be far higher than expected. SpaceX's competitors expected that the upstarts would learn the same hard lesson. There was a chief engineer of another launch provider, I will not say the name, who told me categorically to my face, "You will never land a first stage booster." Martin Hollowell, the chief technology officer at European satellite giant SES, said in 2017, "It is impossible, and even if you do it, it will be completely wrecked." There was a third way to go, beyond parachutes and heat shielding. At least in theory. It was called retropropulsion, which means flying the rocket backward toward Earth on a cushion of hot gas generated by its rocket engines. This was the iconic image of the golden age of science fiction, a rocket landing engine first on an alien planet. The technique had been used in the Apollo lander because the moon has so little atmosphere, but trying it on a planet with a thicker atmosphere would be far more dangerous. Yet if SpaceX could rely on powered flight to slow down the rocket, it would need less expensive heat shielding. Retropropulsion was also a vitally important technology for SpaceX's larger mission of building a city on Mars. You're going to have to land a two-story house on Mars if you're going to send humans. Bobby Braun, a former NASA chief technologist who is now dean of the University of Colorado's engineering school, told me regarding landing schemes to survive on the red planet. Furthermore, he said, a Martian colonizer must land right next to another two-story house that's been pre-positioned and powered up and has all the fuel and food that humans will need to survive on Mars. Putting heavy objects on distant planets has proven extraordinarily difficult for NASA. The heaviest mass sent so far is the near 2,000-pound Mars Curiosity rover, which landed in 2012. To reach the surface, it required a Rube Goldberg contraption that included heat shields, parachutes, and a rocket-fired crane that finally lowered the rover to the ground. The space agency's engineers had been afraid to use rockets earlier in the landing process, at high altitude, flying at supersonic speeds, because they didn't know enough about how such a vehicle would perform. When SpaceX began flying the Falcon 9 at supersonic speeds in Earth's atmosphere, the company shared its data with NASA scientists who were plotting missions to Mars. They were eager to receive it. With supersonic retropulsion, there was no reason to believe it would not work, but there was no reason to believe that it would work. Miguel San Martin, one of those researchers, told me, "In the culture of NASA, we were going to do a big testing program. Elon Musk just tried it, and if it works, it works." In 2011, after the company had flown its Falcon 9, SpaceX hired an engineer named Lars Blackmore from the Jet Propulsion Lab. A product of MIT, Blackmore was an expert in designing software for autonomous vehicles to navigate extreme environments. One academic project had guided a deep-sea submersible robot, and at GPL, he wrote a critical algorithm to guide landers arriving on Mars. His graduate advisor, a NASA veteran himself, said Blackmore would have made a tremendous professor, but he went to SpaceX because it offered an opportunity for the current generation of engineers to make their vision real. At SpaceX, his job was to teach the Falcon 9 to come back to Earth in one piece. That year, Blackmore began work at the Texas Launch Range on the SpaceX project called Grasshopper. It, too, was reminiscent of the DCX, involving a small prototype of a rocket that could launch, hover, and return to Earth. The Grasshopper was just 100 feet tall and mounted on metal struts. In September 2012, it took its first hop into the air. A year later, it flew 3/4 of a mile in its final test. By 2014, the reusability engineers were using a 130-foot-tall, full-scale first stage of the Falcon 9, equipped with 4 space-rated, retractable landing legs. They sent it as high as 3,300 feet in the air to hover before returning to settle gently down on the landing pad. During one test, the landing legs actually caught fire, delivering a biblical image of a flaming sword in the air for any passing eschatologists. During another test, a blocked sensor caused the rocket to veer away from the safe area. Automated software blew the rocket up to prevent it from endangering anyone. The explosion attracted local interest and press criticism, but it did not daunt the engineers. These experiments taught them, and the algorithms controlling the rocket, valuable lessons about how to adjust the engine to compensate for changes in the vehicle's position and the surrounding conditions. They adapted complex mathematical software developed by Stanford computer scientists so that the guidance computers could find a safe path back to Earth with only a tiny margin of error, small enough to guarantee a soft landing inside a 65-foot ellipse on the ground below. Still, the calm conditions and slower speeds of the test range were very different from what a rocket plunging toward Earth from space endures. They needed more data, and the pragmatic SpaceX team had already been gathering it during operational missions. After the Falcon 9's first satellite launch mission in 2013, the booster stage had a secondary mission of its own, steering back down to the ocean. While it didn't make it all the way, it lost control and smashed into the Pacific. The reusability team garnered valuable information about how to fly the unusually shaped vehicle. The open ocean wasn't just a safe place to crash a rocket tumbling back down from space. It was also where the rocket would have to land in order to make reusability work. Strenuous calculations had confirmed that, while it might be ideal to return the booster rocket to Earth in the vicinity of its launch pad, the physics of doing so would prove prohibitive. Rockets do not go straight up when they take off, but rather turn to fly across the Earth and into their chosen orbit at high speed. For missions to destinations in low Earth orbit, like the International Space Station, the rocket would have enough fuel left over to fly back to its landing point. But for missions further up into space, and these were more numerous and more lucrative, the rocket would need to use almost all of its fuel simply to get the job done. After that, unable to return to land, the rocket could be saved only if it returned to Earth offshore, say, for example, on a floating landing pad. This idea was why, in 2014, SpaceX challenged Blue Origin's patents in court. In general, SpaceX did not believe patents would be useful for protecting its intellectual property. Musk saw them mostly as a way of telling competitors, especially those outside the United States, exactly what he had done that was so unique. Blue, on the other hand, seemed to love patents. One of the public signs of Blue's reemergence after 2010 was a proliferation of patent filings on exactly the kind of components needed for reusable rockets. Steerable engines, methods for lightweight construction, and guidance techniques. Just as lifting the heavy equipment needed to colonize Mars motivated SpaceX's desire for reusable rockets, it was equally important to Bezos's goal of shifting industrial capacity into orbit, followed by human civilization writ large. Bezos holds numerous patents related to Amazon's marketplace and subscription services, but he has put his name on only one of Blue's. Sea landing of space launch vehicles and associated systems and methods. The patent is for a reusable space vehicle taking off over the ocean, launching its cargo, then turning its engine back on to descend onto a floating platform. This was exactly what Musk and his team intended to do with the Falcon 9, and SpaceX's attorneys became concerned that even if they beat their competitor to the punch, as seemed likely, they would be vulnerable to litigation. To preempt this situation, they challenged the patent in court, and in doing so offered a brief lesson in the history of the idea to show that it hadn't originated with Blue or SpaceX at all. It had been described in some detail as early as 1998 by a Japanese engineer, Yoshiyuki Ishijima. It was another clash between the two rocket billionaires, and again, it was Musk who came out on top. In early 2015, the judges who reviewed SpaceX's challenge found that the bulk of Blue Origin's claims were too broad to be suitable for a patent. The judges declined to review the remaining two provisions because the descriptions were too indefinite for them to determine whether SpaceX would prevail. While this entailed a rejection of SpaceX's request, it was, in effect, a victory. A patent, deemed indefinite, would be vulnerable to challenge in federal court, and the ruling provided a measure of protection for SpaceX against future litigation by Blue. Now it was simply a matter of actually landing the rockets. In a series of launches in 2014, SpaceX honed the reusability of the Falcon 9. Its engineers repeatedly guided the rocket down to hover above a specific spot in the ocean and then deploy its four landing legs before it ran out of fuel and sank into the waves. In early 2015, the company unveiled two new pieces of technology. One was grid fins, four metal honeycombs, about 5 square feet, mounted on the sides of the rocket. Originally used on ICBMs, they have the ability to rotate and maneuver the rocket by altering the flow of air around it. The other debut was two autonomous drone ships, large barges capable of operating without human crew so that they could safely function as floating landing pads for the rocket booster. The company had one for each ocean. At Vandenberg, on the Pacific, was a ship called Just Read the Instructions, and at Cape Canaveral on the Atlantic was its partner, Of Course I Still Love You. The two names came from a science fiction series favored by Musk about hyper-intelligent AI spacecraft plying the stars. On its fifth mission to the ISS, which went off without a hitch, SpaceX attempted to land a rocket on Of Course I Still Love You for the first time. Musk had warned the press that this was just an experiment, and the company didn't expect it to succeed. And boy, did it not. The hydraulic system controlling the grid fins ran out of fluid due to the number of course adjustments required. The booster came in sideways at high speed, caroming off the edge of the floating platform and bursting apart over the waves. After another flight in April, the rocket touched down on the floating platform almost gently, but a sticky engine valve shut off the engines just a bit too late. The extra momentum made the rocket tip over and blow apart, scattering debris into the blue water. After a later near miss, Musk would adopt a euphemism for its consequences, RUD, or Rapid Unscheduled Disassembly. SpaceX shared videos of these misses on social media, the varied explosive attempts to land the Falcon 9 first stage on the drone ships would become iconic among SpaceX fans and employees, populating a blooper reel of rocket test disasters. The company's decision to stream its launches live on the internet was unusual, as was the decision to tap the company's actual engineers to explain each step of the launch in some detail. As a public relations strategy, it helped underscore how far the company was pushing the limits, even if it created opportunities for people who didn't understand that these were experiments, or who deliberately ignored that fact to call them out as failures. Blue Origin took the opposite approach to publicity, conducting test flights in secret and only then announcing the results. In April 2015, weeks after SpaceX's booster tipped over at sea, Bezos's team finally had some results worth sharing. The company reported that it had launched its new Shepard vehicle, which had been mooted since 2003, for the first time. With Bezos in the control room, the company elevated the stubby rocket and capsule, with Blue's feather logo painted across the entire booster, to its full height of 50 feet. The rocket's engine ignited and it flew 58 miles into the air before the empty capsule separated, soaring on a ballistic trajectory to the edge of space before it fell back to Earth, deploying three parachutes to land safely in the desert. Bezos, in an update published on the company's website, said the test would have been flawless if they had been building an expendable rocket. "We didn't get to recover the propulsion module because we lost pressure in our hydraulic system on descent," which is another way of saying that they dropped the new Shepard onto the ground. It was similar to the fault that betrayed the Falcon 9's first sea landing attempt. A sign that both entrepreneurs were zeroing in on the tools they desired as the terms of their unspoken race became clear. Yet, the two companies were offering a very big difference in scale. The new Shepard was a marvel of engineering, to be sure, but it was about as powerful as the Falcon 1 had been 7 years earlier, and without a second stage to allow it to accelerate satellites to orbital velocity. New Shepard reached 3 times the speed of sound in flight. The Falcon 9 flies 6 times faster than sound or more. True spaceflight is when you need a rocket to get you back down again, space historian David Woods observed in one interview. Blue Origin's vehicle didn't experience the enormous forces faced by the much larger SpaceX vehicle blasting through the atmosphere with 1 million pounds of force behind it. And it was a commensurately similar achievement. Perhaps because of this, Bezos noted that his team would be applying the lessons learned on the New Shepard to a much larger rocket, which would be powered by the engine Blue was building for United Launch Alliance's next rocket. At the same time, though, the difference in scope between SpaceX and Blue Origin was intentional and telling. Bezos' company was not bootstrapping itself into the future with the markets that already existed in space, as Musk's team had with satellite launch. Thanks to its founder's enormous wealth, Blue could aim to create a new market for space tourism that had never existed before. In 2015, the company started signing up interested parties to a mailing list that was advertising its astronaut experience. The New Shepard was perfectly designed to deliver it, an almost gentle rocket that could introduce the public to space in a capsule that, the company promised, had fully 1/3 of its surface covered in windows, an idea that Blue's executives trace to the same relentless customer focus that Bezos calls for at Amazon. Now he could win a new market, but only if his rocket could be reused successfully enough to drive down ticket prices and safely enough to convince people to get on board. And there were plenty of warnings about hubris in commercial spaceflight. Chapter 14. Pushing the Envelope. The first time I took a week off, the Orbital Sciences rocket exploded, and Richard Branson's rocket exploded. The second time I took a week off, my rocket exploded. The lesson here is don't take a week off. Elon Musk. When the Falcon 9 exploded on June 28, 2015, on its 7th mission to the International Space Station, an instant wave of queasiness cascaded all the way from the control room in Cape Canaveral to SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne. Thousands of fans were watching the company's live stream of the launch on YouTube and saw the rocket break apart in the atmosphere just over 1.5 minutes into the mission. It was the 19th flight of a Falcon 9 rocket. It was also the first real operational failure in SpaceX's history. Each previous screw-up had in some way been an experiment. The hardest but best approach is that you pick up the phone and you call them right away, Gwen Shotwell would recall. You can't avoid that. You blew up the rocket and you blew up the Dragon. And perhaps the hardest problem is that you don't have anything else to tell them. The high-speed nature of rocketry and the complexity of the machine make it impossible to know what has gone wrong until engineers have spent several weeks going over data feeds. 3,000 of them in this case, with a fine-tooth comb. They watch video footage of the launch from multiple angles, including from cameras that NASA installed to monitor launches in the wake of the Columbia disaster. And they examine any wreckage they can recover from the ocean. After the failure, as the U.S. Air Force and Coast Guard secured the range and the ocean underneath the explosion, emails flew back and forth between Musk and his engineers, attempting to drill down into what went wrong. Already, SpaceX's team was collecting information and testing theories. It's terrible, but it's not unheard of that rockets blow up. You're taking 1 million pounds of explosive force and trying to shove it down that way. You don't want it to go that way, Shotwell told me with a sideways swipe of her hand. In order to have that 1,000,000 pounds, you've got high-pressure helium systems which shove the propellants into the engine. It's just hard. An hour and a half after the accident, Musk tweeted, "There was an overpressure event in the upper stage liquid oxygen tank. Data suggests counterintuitive cause. That's all we can say with confidence right now. We'll have more to say following a thorough fault tree analysis." And because Elon is Elon, he also found time to reply to a fan's condolences with a brief thanks. The explosion was a major problem not just for SpaceX and NASA, but for the broader idea of space as a service. It was the second strike against the space taxi program. The previous fall, in October 2014, Orbital Sciences had flown the Antares rocket and the Cygnus space capsule, which it had built with NASA's development funding, for the fifth time. During a launch at Virginia's Wallops flight facility, a turbopump in the engine cracked just 6 seconds after liftoff. The resulting conflagration blasted apart the vehicle as well as the launch pad. Like Lockheed Martin and the Atlas V, Orbital had also gone the route of surplus Russian engines, using the NK-33. These engines had been state-of-the-art when they were designed, back in the 1960s. Since then, dozens had been stored away in warehouses. Several different U.S. rocket design programs had considered using them before Orbital selected them to drive the Antares. This didn't impress Musk, who, at 10 years into his self-education as a rocket engineer, was confident enough to mock the decision. "One of our competitors, Orbital Sciences, has a contract to resupply the International Space Station, and their rocket honestly sounds like the punchline to a joke," he told Wired magazine. "It uses Russian rocket engines that were made in the 60s. I don't mean their design is from the 60s. I mean they start with engines that were literally made in the 60s and, like, packed away in Siberia somewhere." Unfortunately, his derision was predictive. The U.S. Space Agency had been proud of having two new space vehicles to service the ISS and was looking forward to the return of human spaceflight to U.S. rocket ranges again. But now, it had zero vehicles. If SpaceX was out of commission for as long as Orbital, it would put great strain on the astronauts in orbit, who now had two fewer vehicles keeping them supplied with food and busy with research projects. The space agencies in Japan and Russia also flew supplies to the station, but a Russian resupply mission had also recently failed, and it was no simple feat to add extra flights to the schedule. Bill Gerstenmaier, the top NASA spaceflight executive, told me that the time he spent preparing policymakers for potential SpaceX and Orbital failures helped them return to flight more quickly afterward. "I wanted to avoid what happened in my world, where we have the failure, the big investigation. It drags on for 3 years. We fix every problem," he told me. "I couldn't tolerate that with these cargo providers. I wanted them to fly absolutely as fast as they could again. I wanted to let folks know we purposely went into this with high risk, and we should expect failures." A long downtime would also give the political opponents of NASA's commercial approach more credibility when they argued for a traditional government program for putting people into orbit. At the time of SpaceX's launch, Orbital had yet to convincingly identify the problem that had blown up its rocket. It was planning to fly its Cygnus spacecraft on the Atlas V in the medium term, an "I told you so" moment for United Launch Alliance. The company was more than happy to step in where a commercial competitor had failed, underscoring its own focus on reliability, and NASA officials applauded Orbital for finding a creative way to keep supplies flowing. "I'm sure there are people that are gleeful when others have failures. It's human nature, and it's a very competitive environment," Shotwell said years later. "I do not applaud when other people fail. I don't get a sense of glee. I think there are some in the industry that do. Even ULA Chief Executive Tory Bruno sent me condolences when we had our failure. Less than a month after the accident, Musk spoke to reporters about the progress of the Failure Investigation Board and identified the cause of the failure. A high-pressure helium tank ricocheting around inside the vehicle after a metal strut from an outside supplier snapped under forces well below its certified tolerance. The incident had been classified as a mishap because there was no loss of life or uninvolved public property. Had the consequences been harsher, it would have been an accident and investigated by the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, with more transparency and independence. As it was, the investigation included 11 SpaceX employees and just one FAA official, who did not sign the final report. Orbital's failure, also classified as a mishap, had been investigated by a board that included two NASA employees and an independent expert. Some of SpaceX's critics were skeptical of the process that had led to the company's final explanation. A separate NASA investigation found several credible causes besides a bad strut from a supplier, including improper installation of the assembly into the rocket and individuals standing on flight hardware during the assembly process. If this were true, it was the kind of sloppiness that Mike Horkachuk, the company's program manager at NASA, feared might seep into the company as it moved from development to operations. The allegations angered SpaceX employees. One told me forcefully that technicians working on any airframe rocket or other hardware are required to walk over it and did not contribute to the strut failure. A board of engineers and the FAA voted and approved the material flaw to be the most probable root cause, not somebody standing on the strut. Still, after the process was completed, Gerstenmayer sent a letter to SpaceX, effectively a reprimand, expressing concerns about the company's systems engineering and management practices, hardware installation and repair methods, and telemetry systems. Wounded pride or no, the company had to make good with NASA, its most critical patron and customer. SpaceX fortified a share of its launch fee, worth about $44 million, renegotiated its contract to add additional future flights at discount prices, and invested in added capabilities for the Dragon, like more in-flight power for science projects. The company also undertook a reorganization under chief engineer Hans Konigsmann, creating reliability teams to build more accountability into design, manufacture, and operations, with more stringent record-keeping. SpaceX employees described this as a time of high stress, with workers being pulled off their main jobs to re-examine every aspect of the Falcon 9 vehicle. Sometimes the people who made the components weren't with the company anymore. Nonetheless, the teams would go back to every file, every system, every design, and reevaluate, make sure we are on the right path. Aaron Beck-Akane, who worked on the Dragon at the time, told me. The NASA Inspector General, who examined the commercial cargo program after the two mishaps, suggested that the space agency might learn from the evolution of the EELV program's approach to mission assurance. Yet it is notable that NASA did not end up adopting the same solution as the Air Force, paying additional money in the form of cost-plus contracts for guaranteed reliability. Instead, SpaceX added those new layers of organization at its own cost. That wasn't the only loss it was taking. The months of delay, while it pinpointed the problem with the rocket and implemented the internal changes to fix it, meant delaying launches and revenues that accompany them. The biggest penalty for SpaceX will be delay of launch rate, Musk told me that summer. If the flights don't take off, we lose the revenue associated with that. The launch revenue will be meaningful in the hundreds of millions because of the implied delays. Leaked financials would later reveal that the company lost $250 million after the accident. The company would push back the launch of its super-powered Falcon Heavy launch vehicle, but it did not want to delay a project considered far more vital to the company's future, reusing its rockets. Since Richard Branson launched Virgin Galactic in 2005, it had struggled to deliver on the commercial promise of the XPRIZE and Spaceship One. Virgin Galactic was partially inspired by Branson's experience in the airline business, which began in 1984 when his flight to a Caribbean island was canceled. He chartered a plane of his own and sold seats to his fellow disgruntled passengers, and then realized he could do the same thing at scale. Branson had made his fortune as a music impresario, and then applied his cheeky touch to a series of ventures that exploited the brand, from retail stores to hotels to cruise ships. In the airline business, he added value by designing a hip experience and marketing campaign, but the planes were the same jets that everyone bought from Boeing and Airbus. He sought to follow the same model with Virgin Galactic, but the market for Spaceship One had so far been limited to Paul Allen and the XPRIZE. To obtain both a mothership and a passenger-carrying spaceplane, Branson created a joint venture with Burt Rutan's Scaled Composites, called the Spaceship Company, TSC. It would be dedicated to building the flight hardware that Virgin Galactic, and perhaps in time other space lines, would market and operate. In practice, this meant that Rutan's Scaled Composites team was working on the hardware while Branson's marketers made promises about it. The new larger vehicle being developed by TSC faced some of the same problems as its predecessor. It was difficult to find a rocket engine small enough and powerful enough to carry it into space. Rutan and his team were still enamored of their hybrid rocket motor, which combined concepts from both solid and liquid rocket engines to fire the space plane once it was dropped from the mothership, called White Knight 2. The company was using nitrous oxide, the laughing gas you might enjoy during a visit to the dentist, as the oxidizer in its engine. One day in 2007, TSC engineers began testing a system that pumped high-pressure nitrous oxide at the Mojave Airport. It was a cold flow test to check out the plumbing that had been used several times before. With no plan to ignite anything, 11 people watched the test from just a few feet away, rather than from a command center behind a protective earthen berm. Seconds after the test began, however, the tank and the equipment exploded. Two people died on the scene, and a third at the hospital shortly thereafter. Three more were injured. A shocked Rutan spoke to reporters afterwards. "We felt it was completely safe. We had done a lot of these with Spaceship One," he said of the test. "We just don't know." To this day, it isn't clear what caused the explosion. Nitrous oxide is considered fairly stable, though it can explode if it reacts with certain compounds or reaches high temperatures. That may have been one cause of the accident, which took place on a hot concrete tarmac in the middle of a summer day in the desert. Some experts believe the tank itself was compromised. California's state safety agency cited Scaled for not training its employees in dealing with the compound or having written safety procedures for how to approach it. Despite the freak nature of the accident, it jibed with suggestions that Rutan's team flew too much by the seat of their pants, as they had in the run-up to winning the XPRIZE. Traditional aerospace tut-tutted about their rough and ready approach, but at the same time needed their creativity. At the time of the accident, Northrop Grumman was in the process of buying out Rutan's share of Scaled. This still left a problem for Branson's team to resolve, one that bedeviled all of the aerospace startups. How do you move from development to operations successfully, maintaining your culture without compromising reliability. Change is an inevitable part of the answer. In 2010, at age 67, Rutan would retire from active work at Scaled. That same year, Branson hired George Whitesides, then the NASA administrator's chief of staff, as the CEO of Virgin and the spaceship company. Whitesides had come far in the decade since he worked at Blastoff. Giving a boost to his mandate was a deal that Branson had cut the year before with the United Arab Emirates. The tiny oil-rich collection of sheikdoms sported a sovereign wealth fund dedicated to funneling its petroleum profits toward long-term investments in technology. Branson, in his own telling, flew to Abu Dhabi and sealed a $280 million investment in Virgin in a single day. The company was revitalized, but adaptations, including a redesign of the fuel tank to dispel any concerns about the use of nitrous oxide, hiring an outside company to redesign the propulsion system, and eventually bringing the project back in-house, pushed back Branson's inaugural flight for years. A decade after Scaled Composites had won the XPRIZE with Spaceship One, Spaceship Two, the actual vehicle, was dubbed VSS Enterprise, was finally entering the critical stage of its test program. It had already been flown as a glider some 30 times to help establish its aerodynamic characteristics, and starting the year before, it had performed three powered flights where the rocket engine was ignited. The Enterprise had reached a maximum altitude of 13 miles, and it seemed only a matter of time before it would get to space. Early on the morning of October 31st, 2014, the Enterprise dropped from its mothership, 50,000 feet over the Mojave, for its fourth powered test. Just like Spaceship One before it, the vehicle relied on adjustable wing booms that would feather up on re-entry to slow it down and maintain the correct angle to avoid breaking apart. During flight, as the space plane accelerated toward the speed of sound, the co-pilot unlocked this rotating wing. This was standard procedure, but only after the rocket had reached full speed and exited the lower atmosphere. Because the wing was unlocked too early, the aerodynamic force on the vehicle overcame the motors that rotated the boom. The wings deployed suddenly, and the force flipped the Enterprise over backward, tearing it apart. The pilot, Pete Siebold, told investigators afterward that he felt enormous G-forces pushing him back into his seat before hearing the cabin crack apart and feeling the air pulled from his lungs. He blacked out and woke up outside the cabin, plunging toward the ground more than 10 miles below. His face hurt from the cold, and the seal on his oxygen mask had broken, leaving him short of breath. He remembered unbuckling himself from his seat and free-falling. Somewhere between 20,000 and 10,000 feet above the ground, his parachute deployed automatically and he was able to land safely in a creosote bush, albeit with an arm broken in multiple places, a fractured collarbone, and bloody scratches. First responders arrived by helicopter after what felt like a really long time. Siebold's co-pilot, Michael Alsbury, was found dead in the wreckage of the Enterprise. He was the first person to perish testing a commercial spacecraft. The accident shook Virgin and the space community, which was still reacting to the orbital mission that had failed just days before. Siebold and Alsbury were respected test pilots who had dedicated their careers to testing next-generation spacecraft for Scaled Composites. Alsbury was survived by his wife and two small children. The two flyers were spiritual descendants of Chuck Yeager and the other rocket plane pilots who came before them, pushing the envelope in an effort to reach the stars. At Virgin Galactic, heavy hearts concluded that the best tribute to Alsbury would be pressing on with the project. Outside the company, critics laid into Branson's over-optimistic promises and speculated about long-running problems with the power of the vehicle's rocket engines. The NTSB's judgment was that Scaled had never considered that a single human mistake could result in the destruction of the entire vehicle. In a situation where busy pilots are required to make precisely timed decisions despite high stress, designers should have anticipated